In the Old Testament, in the book of Job, reading now chapters 3 and 4, and later on chapter 5 of the book of Job. The third chapter, then, of the book of Job, reading from the beginning. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. He said, "May the day of my birth perish, and the night it was said a boy is born, that day, may it turn to darkness. May God above not care about it. May no light shine upon it. May darkness and deep shadow claim it once more. May a cloud settle over it. May blackness overwhelm its light. That night, may thick darkness seize it. May it not be included among the days of the year, nor be entered in any of the months. May that night be barren. May no shouts of joy be heard in it. May those who curse days curse that day, those who are ready to rouse Leviathan. May its morning stars become dark. May it wait for daylight in vain and not see the first rays of dawn, for it did not shut the doors of the womb on me to hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not perish at birth and die as I came from the womb? Why were there knees to receive me and breasts that I might be nursed? For now I would be lying down in peace. I would be asleep and at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who built for themselves places now lying in ruins, with rulers who had gold who filled their houses with silver. Why was I not hidden in the ground like a stillborn child, like an infant who never saw the light of day? There the wicked cease from turmoil, and there the weary are at rest. Captives also enjoy their ease. They no longer hear the slave driver's shout. The small and the great are there, and the slave is freed from his master. Why is light given to those in misery and life to the bitter soul, to those who long for death that does not come, who search for it more than for hidden treasure, who are filled with gladness and rejoice when they reach the grave? Why is life given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? For sighing comes to me instead of food, my groans pour out like water." And notice this verse, "What I feared has come upon me." What does he mean by that? What I dreaded has happened to me. I have no peace, no quietness, I have no rest, but only turmoil. Then Eliphaz the Temanite replied, "If someone ventures a word with you, will you be impatient? But who can keep from speaking? Think how you have instructed many, how you have strengthened feeble hands. Your words have supported those who stumbled. You have strengthened faltering knees. But now trouble comes to you, and you are discouraged. It strikes you and you are dismayed. Should not your piety be your confidence, and your blameless ways your hope? Is there irony there? It was God who said he was blameless. Does Eliphaz agree? Consider now, who, being innocent, has ever perished? Where were the upright ever destroyed? As I have observed, Those who plow evil and those who sow trouble reap it. All the breath of God, at the breath of God they are destroyed. At the blast of his anger they perish. And then this horrible figure to poor Job. The lions may roar and growl, yet the teeth of the great lions are broken. The lion perishes for lack of prey, and the cubs of the lioness are scattered. A word was secretly brought to me, says Eliphaz. My ears caught a whisper of it. Amid disquieting dreams in the night, when deep sleep falls on men, fear and trembling seized me and made all my bones shake. A spirit glided past my face, and the hair on my body stood on end. It stopped, but I could not tell what it was. A form stood before my eyes, and I heard a hushed voice. Can mortal man be more righteous than God? Can a man be more pure than his Maker? If God places no trust in his servants, if he charges his angels with error, how much more those who live in houses of clay, whose foundations are in the dust, who are crushed more readily than a moth? Between dawn and dusk they are broken to pieces. Unnoticed they perish forever. Are not the cords of their tent pulled up so that they die without wisdom? The Old Testament, the book of Job, chapter 5, continuing Eliphaz's first speech to Job. Call if you will, but who will answer you? To which of the holy ones will you turn? Resentment kills a fool, and envy slays the simple. I myself, he says, have seen a fool taking root, but suddenly his house was cursed. His children are far from safety, crushed in court without a defender. The hungry consume his harvest, taking it even from among thorns, and the thirsty pant after his wealth. For hardship does not spring from the soil, nor does trouble sprout from the ground. This is what we were singing. Yet man is born to trouble as surely as sparks fly upward. But if it were I would appeal to God, he says. I would lay my cause before him. He performs wonders that cannot be fathomed, miracles that cannot be counted. He bestows rain on the earth. He sends water upon the countryside. The lowly he sets on high, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. He thwarts the plans of the crafty so that their hands achieve no success. He catches the wise in their craftiness, and the schemes of the wily are swept away. Darkness comes upon them in the daytime. At noon they grope as in the night. On the other hand, he saves the needy from the sword in their mouth. He saves them from the clutches of the powerful. So the poor have hope, and injustice shuts its mouth. Blessed is the man whom God corrects. So Job, do not despise the discipline of the Almighty, for he wounds, but he also binds up. He injures, but his hands also heal. From six calamities he will rescue you. In seven, no harm will befall you. In famine he will ransom you from death, and in battle from the stroke of the sword. You will be protected from the lash of the tongue, and need not fear when destruction comes. You will laugh at destruction and famine, and need not fear the beasts of the earth, for you will have a covenant with the stones of the field, and the wild animals will be at peace with you. You will know that your tent is secure. You will take stock of your property and find nothing missing. You will know that your children will be many, and your descendants like the grass of the earth. You will come to the grave in full vigor, like sheaves gathered in season. We have examined this, he says, and it is true. So Job, hear it and apply it to yourself. Well then, considering what we looked at last Sunday evening in the first two chapters of Job, the double scene is set, upstairs and downstairs, on earth and in heaven, for Job's multiple contest. His contest with his three friends, so-called, and then a fourth, and indeed with the God he knows and the Satan he apparently doesn't know. Not to say also the contest with himself. We are given by the writer the earthly scene and the heavenly, and we are expected to work out our understanding of what subsequently transpires. And the thing which amazes me is that most of the interpreters who seek to interpret this drama regard it as far more mysterious than it seems to me it is or should be to those who have the first two chapters as their guide. Of course, if people don't really believe in a real live devil, they almost deserve their mystification. But those who do believe in him, I didn't say believe him, but those who do believe in him should carry that knowledge, the knowledge that we have in the first two chapters, through every subsequent verse that they read. And they will never forget the fact. And this is what we propose to do. And having witnessed in the narrative thus far the losses of Job, his appalling personal suffering, the opposition of his wife, and what we are to hear from these four men, even although we noted last week the marvelous restraint of these three men when they came and wept aloud, tore their clothes, put dust on their heads, and sat down to mourn silently with Job for seven whole days and nights, all of which drove the man nearly mad. I say, having witnessed all that, we are to try to weigh the total situation as it develops in respect of all these characters, so that at last we may come to the fullest understanding of Job's excruciating anguish, and also are able fully to appreciate the glorious outcome of the drama. Driver and Gray suggest that the devout and resolute Job suffered for months before his friends from afar came to him. Matthew Henry notes that each of these three men were descended from Abraham. Well, if it took so long for them to arrive, having heard of Job's plight and coming from different directions apparently, if it took them so long, then Job had time to think in the midst of his travail. Then when they arrived, there were these seven days and nights of apparent deep silence, when they sat and said not a word. Well, we know that when calamities come suddenly upon us, it takes time for them to sink in. We've heard that in many hands in these days. of those who have suffered from this disaster. It takes time for the awful, the terrible, the shocking truth to sink in. And so the first reaction of a devout and godly man to his trouble may be ringing and buoyant. But time for reflection, and the days and the weeks, probably months of persistent suffering, take their toll. And Satan, who instigated it all, although challenged by the Lord, Satan moves in to consolidate what I suppose he would call his good luck and make the most of it for poor Job. And by the time the silence is broken, Job is about ready to explode, and so he breaks out in curses that ever he was born, as if in chapter 3, verse 4, he was attributing his birth to other than God, although there's no indication that he is aware of any alternative deity. But something I hadn't noticed before in a number of studies in Job through the years, he mentions so early Leviathan, and we'll read plenty about him in chapter 41, when I believe the Lord reveals to Job the nature of his tempter under the figures, the dual figures of Behemoth and Leviathan, creatures for all their power, as the writer shows, completely under the Lord's control. But you see, it's one thing to believe in dark, sinister beings, quite another to see them on the Almighty's leash, as we see police dogs today in violent scenes, under control. Now, Job wouldn't impugn God, but is it difficult for us to see who he's getting at here? At least he wished he had died at birth. Then death would be sweet. Well, at least better than this. Ah, but there's the rub, Job. There's the rub. Death. And thereafter, let the rich man of Lazarus's experience tell him about after death. For even infants partake of Adam's sin and need redemption. Why is light given to those in misery and life to the bitter in soul who long for death and would eagerly come to it if they could? Job. That is, of course, the mystery which is bound up with our brave God's adventurous choices. His choices to see how free he can make souls that he has created, free to do his will willingly. Whereas birds and beasts, rivers and trees have no choice, as we have, as Paul tells the Romans, but are subject to frustration, not of their own will. But men and angels are really free and are given the glorious but dangerous opportunity to please their God, or else what? Well, that may be the mystery. And so Job goes on in his first spiel to name God as hedging him in, and whom he is undoubtedly calling in question. And so Eliphaz, shocked, gulps and barges in. He begins by reminding Job of the man he had been, and in chapter 4, verses 3 and 4, gives him an excellent character as a caring person in the past. But Job, you can't take your own medicine when it is offered to you. To which we feel like saying, do we not, in defense of the poor sufferer, just you come down here, Eliphaz, and share Job's plight. and see if it is as easy as that to swallow what you have conscientiously prescribed to others. But no, Eliphaz is allowed to go on, speaks on. Where's your piety now, Job, and your blameless ways, which God boasted of? Well, they're out of the window like a caged bird escaping the prison of vapid religiosity. Consider, Job, when did the innocent ever perish, or the upright ever be destroyed? You reap what you sow. Good, sound, straight, ethical stuff. And reading that, you may say, my, as your righteous soul warms to this man Eliphaz, this is a man after my own heart. He is bound to make Job squirm. Yes, but is that what the sufferer was needing then? There can be few things so cruel as the truth misapplied. The truth misapplied. As indeed there can be few things so injurious as the truth finding its wrong mark. Think of the persistent practice until lately. I hope it's until lately. Common in some evangelical circles of resolutely preaching a gospel suitable only to the unconverted, the unsaved, to an entirely regenerate congregation, and even to the extent that if a preacher should deviate from the approved gospel cliches, they are charged with not preaching the gospel. And it's that attitude that has hardened generations of evangelicals and has made the task of preaching and teaching the whole Word of God with its personal challenge to consecration all the harder. Many of us have suffered excruciatingly from those who have become so gospel-hardened that the message of the cross directed to their consciences has made them literally mad. Many times in these chapters, when these three men are speaking God's truth roundly, we will have to say, surely, this is the wrong sermon preached to the wrong man. Fancy using, as Eliphaz does in chapter 4, verses 10 and 11, fancy using the destruction of a den of lions as a figure of God's punishment of the wicked to a man in Job's plight. Did you ever read anything so insensitive and inappropriate? Good gracious! And then Eliphaz confides a personal experience to Job. This is more than interesting. It reads something like a nightmare that he had. Not a bit like the dreams of Joseph, or of the two royal servants, or even of Pharaoh that we've been reading of in Genesis. But I'm amazed that apart from the inappropriateness of the instance Eliphaz gives, no one seems to believe that what he describes comes from the pit and not from God. Do you? The whole experience, Eliphaz's whole experience of demoralizing terror and quaking, and the unidentified spirit gliding past his face and making his hair stand on end, is nothing like the fear of Isaiah chapter 6, Daniel chapter 10, Paul 2 Corinthians 12, or John Revelation chapter 1. Nothing like it. Ah, but you say the message is from God. Well, is it? You say the commentaries assume so. I don't care. If what Eliphaz seems to apply to Job is applied to a godless man very well. The devil could do that because he knows the principles of the gospel well enough. Else he couldn't be the accuser of the brethren, as he is. But the devil wouldn't apply it to his own. Trust him. He applies the truth perversely and utterly wrongly to the saints of God, doesn't he? Of course, Job knows at least as well as Eliphaz that mortal man cannot be more righteous or more pure than his Maker. God would never think of trusting sinner man unaided, and he certainly charges all but the holy angels with error, much more man who is of the dust and could be crushed like a moth, or like the temporary dwelling of a tent which can be pulled up and away as if it had never been there. Job doesn't need to be told that, Eliphaz. What's that to do with a man as righteous as Job, even if he does emit the most heart-rending cries because of his sufferings? Do you think that Eliphaz saw and treasured up as a message from God to believing souls? And what he most shockingly applied to the poor sufferer, that he believed it came from God? Well, you have heard Job convincing me of that. But you may say, whatever Eliphaz had known of Job in his palmy days, what Job has admitted in that appalling chapter seems to suggest that Job is so angry with God that he is about to abandon him altogether. Well, it may read like that, if you don't take a long view. But has the silent sympathy of 7 days and night not taught these three men something of the depths of the suffering of this man, enough to turn poor Job so that his mind is almost gone? Is nothing to be allowed for his near dementia? As with those who, however it started, are plagued with uncontrollable forces in their lives? Oh, but says Eliphaz in chapter 5, resentment kills a fool and envy slays the simple. Who is going to listen to you, Job, inveighing against God like that? Such folly can only come to disaster and destruction, since man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upwards. If I were you, he says to Job, if I were you, if he were Job in that state, would he be so glib? Don't let us forget at any point in this study what this man is constantly suffering night and day. Because if we do, we will miss the point of the message by being sidetracked by its sheer wealth of ethical or theological allusion and imagery. And we mustn't lose the message in its wonderful literature. If I were you, says Eliphaz, I would appeal to God. Do you see him stroking himself? And lay my case before him. He's a wonderful God, you know. He performs miracles upon his own nature that he has created, and thwart the nefarious plans of the crafty, catching the so-called wise in their stratagems so that they are plunged into gloom and darkness even at noontide and have to grope for the light. And thus such a God saves the needy out of their malign clutches and gives the poor hope, he says. So Job, come to God and confess your sin. Not only the sin of your outburst, but by implication the sin which has brought all this suffering upon you, the hidden sin that none of us sees but you see and God sees. If only you repent, Job, God will be merciful, and your loathsome physical and mental plight will soon be over, and God will restore you to what you were before, and better, because you will be a more upright man. For he, the Lord, is the rescuer of those who have plunged themselves into sinful calamities, and he will protect you from those who would destroy you, so that you will soon be able to laugh at these sorrows when you have repented to the depth of your sinful soul, because God will cause the whole world to turn toward you, and you will find that on all levels, from the most natural to the most moral and spiritual, things will begin to go well with you, Job. You will regain your flocks and herds, and God will give you as many children as you had before, and your descendants will yet be as many as the grass in the field. You will come to the grave in full vigor, like sheaves gathered in due season. Now, Job, this is the truth, he says. I have examined it, as if that was the very last word, and know that what I say is the truth, so you'd better hear it and apply it. I'm distracted in quoting what Eliphaz says because I'm thinking of a dear woman who ended her days in King's Seat Hospital many, many years ago, who used to worship here. A dear misguided evangelist for years tried to get the soul converted. And when she first came here, unorthodox, unconventional, eccentric soul as she was, I got to know her and knew in the midst of all the peculiarities of her life that she truly loved the Lord. She had seen her husband shoot himself, and that had almost demented her, and yet her faith kept her then. But that man went on until he drove her into the asylum and she died there. How terrible to be so undiscerning of souls, because they don't satisfy all our cliches. What a way to talk to a man as anguished as Job. Because like the psalmists, yes, the psalmists, page after page, he cries out. I wonder what God thought of that speech of Eliphaz. But let's assess the facts so far. I don't mean from the very beginning, because that would short-circuit our arguments. But from the moment that these three men appeared, and first sat silently in sympathy, and then heard this extraordinary outburst of chapter 3 by Job. Now, of course, these were terrible things for any man to say, any believer to say, however dire his anguish and agony. Curse the day of his birth, and curse those who let him live when he was born. That day should be blotted out of remembrance. It should never have belonged to God's plan or purpose at all. May professional cursers be employed here, he says, even those who are able to call up Leviathan, the sea monster who represents the powers of evil. Douse the light of the sun or the stars, and let the light shut its doors to hide this trouble from his eyes. Then Job goes on to ask, why is light given to the bitter so that they have to endure afflictions? Why doesn't God put an end to suffering humanity's woes and adopt a system of euthanasia, which we were reading at prayer last Saturday, most Chinese favor in hopeless cases, euthanasia. Adopt a system of euthanasia for those liable to suffer cancer or multiple sclerosis or Alzheimer's disease. Why is life given to a man who cannot see any way ahead, whom God has hedged in? Sighing is my food, he says, and groans my drink. What I feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened to me, and I have no peace or quietness, I have no rest, but only turmoil. Well, that's a revelation, isn't it? Who would have thought that half of these thoughts could emerge from righteous Job's pious breast and heart? But they have done. It's written down. But then, you see, we never know what we are capable of when the powers either of good or of evil begin to work on us. And Job is learning a lot about himself as he speaks. And I could imagine that even before Eliphaz began to speak, Job was saying to himself, despite his pain and comfort, what's that I'm saying? What is that that's coming out of my mouth? Am I hearing myself right? But you see, what he has suffered in two waves of appalling trouble and tragedy has almost turned his mind. He is not himself, and yet he is himself, for he is only seeking out of the darkness and mist of his inexplicable torment to find an answer to his plague. And he doesn't know at all what has gone on up in the heavenlies about dare I use this word? Job doesn't know at all what has gone on upstairs in heaven about the bargain God has made with Satan to try Job to the utmost degree. God couldn't do it himself, else he couldn't be God. But Satan is always ready to oblige, too ready. Nor does Job know that God would never have drawn Satan's attention to him and allowed the devil to take such fearful liberties with a poor man if the Lord had thought his prize character Job would not endure and survive. Did not God know from the beginning that Job would emerge from his trials? Of course he did. But Job didn't know it, because he had no idea what had hit him. Only that he wouldn't charge God with wrong, however bad it was. But you see, when it goes on for months, and there is no sign of relief, you begin to think, and it makes you wonder, and your faith in God is under the greatest strain, and you are tempted to say things about God, and perhaps even to God, that in your sanest, most sanctified moments, you would never dream of letting over your lips. But there's just this that strikes me. And I don't know that I had noticed it before, although probably I did, but didn't dare pursue it. What was it at chapter 3, verse 25, Job feared and dreaded? Did these dreads that he speaks of here take place before his trouble began? If so, then that would mean that either God gave Job some intimation that trouble was ahead of him, or, as I would rather think, it may have meant that God allowed Satan to intimate to Job what he purposed to do. But it seems to me that Satan would only have done that after the Lord drew Satan's attention to Job's upright character and blameless life. One would hardly think that a man of Job's caliber was normally subject to satanic intimations and dreads and fears of that dimension, would you? Anyway, it's something to think about more. And that's what I'm determined to do. There may be a hint, indeed, further on, which could tie in with that 25th verse. So in driver's terms, we read these words, "For I fear a fear, and it comes upon me, and that which I dread comes upon me." To think about that. But back to the main message of these chapters before we go on in subsequent weeks, God willing. I have been given a book by Jeanette Gordon, who used to keep the Church of Scotland book room at Alford Place when I was a student, not yesterday. Her father was professor of Old Testament literature at Presbyterian College, Montreal. And the book is entitled The Poets of the Old Testament. And in it, Professor Gordon refers to that doyen of Old Testament scholars of those days. The book is dated 1912, A.B. Davidson, that Hebrew scholar, who in turn was influenced by Delisch and Dillman to the effect that the problem of the book of Job, if there is one, he says, is not that which bears on the difference which took place in Job following his sufferings, because, says Professor Gordon, the whole center of interest changes. In the poem, he means the book of Job, in the poem, the Satan and his cynical assaults on human goodness vanish, he says. It is no longer Job's piety, but God's justice that is in question. Even as Godey, the scholar, admits and says, the being who is brought to the bar of judgment is in reality not Job, but Jehovah. The point, he goes on, in debate is not only the virtue of Job, it is at the same time and in still higher degree the justice of God. And Professor Gordon continues, and Job is now the Prometheus who boldly joins issue with the Almighty. The problem, he says, of the poem is to reconcile faith with the inequalities of his providence. And it ends in God's appearing not to reveal to his steadfast servant the meaning of his sufferings, but to vindicate God's own character as worthy of trust and love. Now, I appreciate all this, as I'm sure those of you who know the book of Job do. But to my mind, and I cannot get beyond it, the main lesson of the book is the incomprehension of Job before abysmal troubles. Because he did not know, as we the readers of the book are given to know from the beginning, that Job's trouble arose because the Almighty was so proud of Job's uprightness and blamelessness, and of that peculiar quality of compassionate service of his fellow men, which he himself refers to in chapters 29 and 31, that the Almighty was ambitious to polish him further. And that, to polish him further, Satan was far too willing to do by friction. He longed to be the polisher, although that wasn't his intent. He wanted to hurt and destroy Job if he could. Thus, in the end, Job had to learn that what caused all his trouble was the divine permission to afflict him, that he might emerge an even brighter saint, far more blessed of the Lord, even in earthly things than before. And I still hold to this, not only in respect of the book of Job, but in respect of the whole biblical revelation, that God, in the soaring perfections of his sovereign will, would have creatures approximating to his own being as near as possible. Indeed, of his eternal Son's own nature, as Peter says. And yet, gathering up the dust of the earth into divinity, but not deity. Peter speaks of us partaking of the divine nature. And that, of course, could only be achieved by affording mankind that autonomy of free will and choice, which would make them real characters and not puppets. Puppets like the beasts and growing things, which St. Paul says do not have such choice. Hence arises all the evil, which indeed would have been an embarrassment to a lesser God than we have. The Almighty envisaged all this, and the risks, the seeming risks and hazards it would involve him in by creating such dangerous beings, dangerous and threatening to the perfect world he would create. Because God knew that he could not only cope with it all the evil, but that he would use the ensuing evil, which must arise from his creatures' wrong choices, he would use the ensuing evil for good, and ultimately for his greater glory. The glory of the eternal Christ before he became man is one thing, but the glory of the Christ after his passion and almighty work of redemption is quite another. And his saints partake not only of the fruit of the one, the pre-incarnate Christ, but of the other, the post-incarnate Christ, not post in the sense that Christ ceases to be man, for he is man forever, and we are men forever in him with new bodies, like his immortal, eternal, and ever-glorious body. Thus, as Christ shines more gloriously in heaven at the right hand of the Father after his earthly ordeal and achievement of the purchase of his church, so Job, after his ordeal, shines even on the earth far more brightly than ever he did when God Almighty said those superlative things about him that inspired the devil's jealous rage and spite. In the process of Job's appalling agonies, he often sounds to us, and doubtless to his three friends, as if he had abandoned all faith, not least in that poignant third chapter. And God in the end points out dear Job's faults and sins, especially that of not understanding or believing that God could cope with all the evil and keep it under control, as he also controls Leviathan and Behemoth. But if God in his inscrutable wisdom permits us to know that our blessed Redeemer in his agony, sinless agony, as Job's agony could not be sinless, if God in his inscrutable wisdom permits us to know that our blessed Redeemer cried out in desperation, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Then the Almighty can contain Job's outrageous outbursts of sheer incomprehensibility and yet ultimately commend him for the steadfastness of his faith and rebuke his friends for their incrimination of him under such appalling stress. But you see, we've only begun our search for the full meaning of this great book, and we must be content meantime with these observations, constantly crying to God for ever more light to shine on a book of holy writ which calls for all our powers and all the aid of the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit will give us to understand our own faith and what it is we have to learn down here, which is going to minister not only to God's glory up there, but to our glory also. The more we probe into these things, which God legitimately gives us to see and understand, the more we probe into them, surely the better the quality of our life and service in the Lord and for the Lord, to His glory and to our everlasting blessing. Now, I'm going to close by reading you a poem which I received the other day from one who, in my long experience, is perhaps the nearest to Job's sufferings I have known. He's a Church of Scotland minister who has had to give up his charge for a multiplicity of complex reasons. I speak with this chap on the phone hours every week, and so his plight has entered peculiarly into my soul. And I read these lines, shocking I called them to him. I read them really with a breaking heart. He has entitled them Deception, Deception, a Prayer of Complaint. When I survey the anguished path so long endured, I ask, how can I trust you any more, Lord? You say your hand's not shortened, that it cannot save, and yet I plunge, it seems, towards an early grave. My tears have been my bitter food both day and night. Where is your God? Taunt voices hidden from sight. 1 year I have languished weak and faint upon my bed. Unless you act, I'd rather soon be dead. The youthful visions dreamed are known to you alone. A single mind, a single heart became your throne. In all its facets, life expanded, Christ imbued. Even for your honor, all alone, one stood, while others chose a lower road, and I the higher. Temptations reared their many heads, but yield? Would I? My eyes were straining toward the goal, and so, in dread of grieving you from sin and compromise, I fled. Is this a boast? No, you had touched with holy fire my heart, and so with inner strength I did not tire of waiting patiently to grasp your perfect will. Like little child at mother's breast, my heart was still. I preached, and faces radiated deepening trust, rejoiced with those who joyed, and wept with those sore crushed. The word confirmed, by lives transformed. What greater prize to lose oneself in this grand task, to touch the skies? But now I dwell in limbo land, unrecognized by church and even by stalwart friends somewhat despised. Rejection is the leitmotif which, woven through the tapestry of life, is now its dominant hue. I curse the day on which my mother gave me birth, who melancholy life bequeathed me, void of mirth. Even precious friends you've taken, now I'm all alone. Just, and here he quotes what he calls the bargeman at the end of Delius's A Village, Romeo and Juliet. Just passing strangers drifting by, they have become. Whence and when will help come? Must I scream or cry? Or will they wonder later, did we help him die? My heart is overwhelmed with grief. How can I bear this hurt? The man of sorrows fleetingly draws near, then vanishes my weary soul to tantalize. Or is it some demonic warrior in disguise? The scores of Strauss and Mahler, read and understood. The tempo, timbre, balance, and the shifting mood, kaleidoscopic echo of my soul's poor state, lone solace in my prison house to share my fate. You're too old to conduct, I'm told. Shall I compose a song then, or a dirge, or something grandiose? My early music's inspiration sweat is dry. Reminder, cruel, that time is passing by. To preach, compose, or help the needy, which to do when health is also now denied me? How can you just judge, look on, and watch me sway in this soul fog? What father treats his child like this, or even his dog? Answer me now, O righteous God, hear my complaint. My body wastes, my mind is tense, my heart grows faint. O rend the heavens, come down, if you dare. And tell me why you still ignore my desperate prayer. If I were righteous Job-like, I could comfort draw that sufferings were dispensed to me by some kind law. Had I to glorify you through a bed of pain, I could adjust to that in time, for there is rain as well as sunshine. Each the other does enhance. But your mind seems to change, O God. What is your stance? And so, here he quotes the first line from a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins on the wreck of the Deutschland. And so, thou mastering me, God, thou mastering me, God, you let me be deceived. I staked my all on promises, not now believed. What do you want of me, great God, my life, my death? Oh, choose the latter, give relief, make cease my breath. And then a verse in the German, taken from Mahler's song, the farewell song of Mahler, Song of the Earth. I'll not read the German, but the English. Whither am I going? I'll wander in the mountains. I seek rest for my lonely heart. My heart is still and awaits its hour. And then this from himself. Why to me this unceasing pain? Shall I tell you what I think about that? There are still Jobs in our world, you know, who go through agonies like that and maybe worse. And because most people do not understand and are apparently only prepared to help where they do understand, they tend to leave such souls alone. I do not understand. Therefore I cannot help. What a fallacy. I'm amazed at the limits of tolerance of Christians, so ready to judge suffering souls for their bitterness. For if the book of Job teaches us one thing, it is to eschew the attitude of Job's comforters and to be prepared to sit long, often perhaps in silence, and share with such sufferers at least a little of their agony, knowing that if they are believers, it will have an end, if not down here, blessedly, there.